You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
It's been 50 years since Martin Luther King Jr. drew 300,000 people to Washington, D.C. for the March for Jobs and Freedom. That march and King himself have become major touchstones of our national history. And in his biographical trilogy called America in the King Years, Pulitzer Prize winner Taylor Branch chronicled the civil rights movement with a focus on King. Now he has slimmed down those volumes into one concise work while maintaining their distinctive storytelling style. He's called this new version The King Years, Historic Moments in the Civil Rights Movement. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Taylor Branch back to our show. Hello.
Thank you, Leonard. Nice to be back.
Did you intend this to be the condensed version of the trilogy, which took you something like 24 years to write and ran over 3,000 pages?
Yeah, it was very long, and I got complaints over the years from readers who said that their collarbones were broken and they couldn't take it on airplanes and this, that, and the other. But mostly it was teachers that did it. It was teachers over the years who said they loved the stories, but they couldn't really assign 800-page books to college students, although there are a lot of college students who take it, but not high school. And I think that that's an opinion worth honoring.
Well, you've chosen 18 essential moments from the civil rights movement to highlight in this book. There must have been hundreds. How did you choose which ones to include and which to leave out?
There's a lot of blood on my office floor. It was very hard. I had to unwrite 95% of what I spent all this time doing. I picked moments that I thought could communicate the whole sweep of a transformative era, and it turned out to be 18. I didn't know that going in. From the dawning of a movement until you see a movement capture history and then see it recede.
And not always things that we might expect to find here. For example, you include the 1964 Republican and Democratic National Conventions.
Oh, absolutely. It's part of my awareness going back through this that our memories are so much out of tune that was such a profound event in which the parties switched places overnight in one summer, and they have ever since, owing to the influence of race, that the Democrats, which for a century had been the party of segregation, look at the Lincoln film, you know, even the Democrats from New York were opposed to the 13th Amendment. And they were trying to, their president, Lyndon Johnson, was endorsing the Civil Rights Bill. The Republicans, who were founded as a party for black rights and had been the party of Lincoln, had been so. Over 80% of the Republicans voted for the Civil Rights Bill in the summer of 64, but their candidate, Barry Goldwater, announced that he was opposing the Civil Rights Bill as a usurpation of states' rights, and instantly the very first Republicans in the South sprang up with a whole new vocabulary of denouncing the federal government, and that's changed our politics ever since.
And many Democrats in the South switched parties as well.
Absolutely. Strom Thurmond was the first prominent one that very same year. He'd been a lifelong Democrat. He stood up.
When he was a Dixiecrat.
Said this is another Reconstruction, and it is a concentration of all power in the central government, and there'll be no freedom unless we oppose it.
And Kennedy and Johnson had been warned that if they pursued this path, that it would cause problems for the Democratic Party.
Absolutely. But they created a party. They turned the Democratic Party into one that sought to have multi-ethnic, multi-racial coalitions, and it has plagued them ever since.
And in fact, during the last election and the previous election, there were people who said that the Democratic Party is really just too focused on minority rights.
Yeah.
And that there are larger issues that America should be concerned with.
There's always been an element ever since 1960. A lot of today's politics is still an echo of 1964. This is one reason I wanted to do this, is that I'm hoping that the 50th anniversaries that are beginning to march, or the March on Washington, the Birmingham church bombing, 64 Civil Rights Act, this historic switch of parties will help us get our memory straight about what this era really meant.
So what did you think when you started hearing after the election of Barack Obama, the first election, that we were in a post-racial situation?
That people always remember race the way they want to, and when they say it isn't race, it usually is.
When you devoted 24 years, at least based on publication, to writing the three volumes on King. What were the most surprising things you learned about him while you were researching America in the King Years trilogy?
Well, from the trivial that he wasn't born Martin Luther King, that his name was Michael until his father changed it for egotistical reasons that embarrassed his son. So to name him after Martin Luther? To name himself. Yeah. His daddy King named himself after Martin Luther. And since young Mike was a junior, he became Martin Luther King Jr. So from the trivial little biographical facts like that, I think the most basic one is the surprise of how balanced his oratory was, with one foot in the scriptures and one foot in the Constitution, that kept him somehow from getting attacked ever for mixing church and state, even though he did it every day.
And it's interesting that so much of it was spoken off the cuff, without all the ums and the wells that we expect when people are ad-libbing. Is that because he'd grown up testifying? There is a tradition in the black church where people testify, and they're expected to speak quite fluently.
Yes, they were expected to speak quite fluently. He was embarrassed again by his father, who he said walked the benches, meaning get up on top of the pews and kind of become vaudeville and a hooping preacher. But he was a trained orator. He believed in it. He studied it. In the black tradition, he was an intellectual trained author, orator, who, like black preachers, saw themselves also as a jazz musician. Even the I Have a Dream speech, the part that we know were riffs that he had been developing all along. It's kind of like a musician.
So it was improvised, but he was drawing upon things that he had said in the past. It's like a musician who practices certain riffs and then puts them together during the solo.
And sees what works. He was acutely sensitive to what worked with the audience.
And were you surprised when you learned that?
Yes, I was, because I didn't realize that oratory was, it escaped me that it was that much of an art, and that it would be that much of an art in a black context that made it like jazz music.
Well, today, of course, we expect all of our politicians to be reading every word of the script.
Right.
And it's just a matter of how well they read that we determine how effective they are.
King had a phenomenal memory. A lot of those things read like scripted sermons, but he very seldom had a manuscript in front of him.
The original New York Times book review of Parting the Waters by Eleanor Holmes Norton said, the contribution of this book is not that it tells us why racial change occurred, but how. Was that your goal in this book as well?
Yeah, my goal was to make it personal so that people could feel it, because I'd been so frustrated by the more analytic books about the civil rights movement that use all these labels to analyze it. And I think that those labels are false, like fool's gold. They don't really discover anything until it's personal.
They also tend to focus on the leaders and ignore the people who came out and did a lot of the hard work.
Yes, and so far, even my publisher was struck by the fact that I only chose 18 moments in this to do the movement from start to finish. But a lot of them are not focused on Martin Luther King. There are several on Bob Moses. There are several on Diane Nash and other people like that that were essential figures in an era of this magnitude.
A recent documentary argued that Bayard Rustin played a key role in the civil rights movement that has been largely overlooked because he was gay, and that caused trouble for Dr. King, who dropped him at one point. But
he did.
He's the guy who organized the March on Washington.
He was blackmailed to drop Bayard Rustin by Adam Clayton Powell, of all people. That's quite a very painful story in 1960. The March on Washington rescued Bayard Rustin. I'll never forget him telling me that all the press people were treating him as a wizard. They put him on the cover of Life magazine. He said, "I know why you're doing it. You're doing it to take the egg off your face, because you said there was going to be Armageddon if black people came here. And now you can say this wizard put porta potties all along the mall and made those Negroes nice enough for tea." Bayard was a very remarkable character.
Taylor Branch, his latest book is The King Years, Historic Moments in the Civil Rights Movement. How early in his life did Martin Luther King adopt the philosophy of nonviolence as a way of getting things accomplished?
Well, it's easy to forget that every Christian preacher and minister is trained in nonviolence as a matter of religious belief, that Jesus was nonviolent. But as a social tactic and a political tactic. It wore after the bus boycott, and it took him some time.
So it wasn't Gandhi?
It was definitely not Gandhi. I mean, he read Gandhi, but he didn't really admire him. And actually, when he went over to India, he came back saying, you know, those Gandhians are crazy. They're half of them that won't step on ants, and Nehru is building the atomic bomb. And they fast all the time, but none of them have ever eaten barbecue. So he said, we need to form our own American nonviolence, because we're not a majority the way Gandhi's Indians were.
And he learned from watching what other people were already doing here. SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, had its roots in sit-in protests that predate King?
No. They started in 1960. King's distinctive attitude toward the SNCC, which was formed out of the sit-ins, these college students, was that he was the only adult leader to praise them instantly as a breakthrough, because he was frustrated as a trained orator that he couldn't preach America out of segregation. But he knew that there's some parts of human nature that are so stubborn that you need witness, that words aren't enough. And so he recognized the nonviolent students as a breakthrough, which was quite remarkable at the time.
And most of the focus was on the South. But in 1966, Dr. King moved to Chicago to draw attention to the plight of black poor people there and in other northern cities. What did his advisors and colleagues think of that decision?
They were all against it, just like they were against him going to Selma, which he had already just done. For the last half of his career, he was dragging his staff. None of them wanted to go to Chicago because they didn't know much about it. But he said he felt a sense of urgency to demonstrate that race in America was not and never had been purely sectional, that it was all over the country. And there were a surprising number of people, he felt, that believed that when the Southern segregationists and tobacco-chewing sheriffs went away, that the race problem was over.
But near the end of his life, he expressed concerns about all sorts of other things. Did his advisors try to dissuade him from opposing the war in Vietnam, for example, or later trying to put together the Poor People's March?
They did, consistently. He gave his anti-Vietnam speech because he promised one advisor, James Bevel, and people thought he was nuts. The whole last part of King's career, from the passage of the Civil Rights Act to Selma, to the North, to Vietnam, to the Poor People's Campaign, and finally to Memphis, was a prophetic drive that got stronger. I call it the downward King. The first part of the movement was up to pass the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Then he dragged his staff downward until he's among the sanitation workers in Memphis at the end. It's very prophetic.
But do you think that in the end he was more effective because there were these other protest movements? There was a women's movement. There was the anti-war movement. And the civil rights movement, and although maybe his advisors felt that they should be kept separate, I think for many people, they all started to merge.
Well, they certainly did, in the sense that this race is the doorway, and that's the lesson that I hope we'll recover. Race is the doorway to equal citizenship, and once Americans dealt with race after Birmingham in 1963, it opened equal citizenship for women, and even for gays. The word gay didn't even exist then, but that's where it came from, and that's part of what I hope we will acknowledge now.
What kind of relationship did he have with other leaders in the black community? Well, Elijah Muhammad, Malcolm X.
Very sparse, respectful. You know, Malcolm X went to see him in Selma right before Malcolm X was killed to pay his respects. And everybody in King's circle was terrified. King was in jail. But Malcolm X got up and gave a very surprising speech in which he told the people in Selma, I am not here to ask you to do anything that you wouldn't do. I just pray that God will take all the fear away from your heart.
Because they had very different visions of America
totally
in the future.
Different visions.
Now, also with a different vision was J. Edgar Hoover.
Yes, I have to have a chapter in here about J. Edgar Hoover trying to blackmail King and get him to commit suicide instead of accepting the Nobel Peace Prize. It's a real tightrope here between the level of tyranny that Hoover practiced, kind of a bureaucratic tyranny, and a faithful or grudging acceptance that he was probably the most gifted bureaucrat in the history of the United States.
Well, Dr. King was unfaithful to his wife, and mm-hmm. that's at odds with the current image we have of him. What do you think about the way that he's remembered now with the uncomfortable parts removed?
Well, I think there's a certain tendency to make a plaster saint out of every iconic figure, whether it's George Washington or Thomas Jefferson, and some of that has happened to Dr. King, too. But the longer I worked on him, the more respect I gained in spite of these flaws for him. I really see him as the equivalent of a founding father or a modern founder in the sense that just like our founders, he confronted hierarchy and subjugation and put us in motion toward equal citizenship. It's no accident that there had never been anybody talking about a female rabbi in 2,000 years of rabbinic Judaism, but within a few years of the civil rights movement, when they started, got people struggling with equal souls and equal votes, you had the very first ordained female rabbi. Now we take it for granted, but what I'm hoping is that people will see that this is where it came from.
Taylor Branch is the best-selling author of books that include Parting the Waters, America in the King Years, 1954-63, Pillar of Fire, America in the King Years, 63-65, and At Canaan's Edge, America in the King Years, 65-68. He won the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Critics Circle Award. His new book is The King Years, Historic Moments in the Civil Rights Movement, published by Simon & Schuster, and he will be speaking at the New York Historical Society tonight at 6:30. That's at 160 Central Park West. For more information, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. Thank you so much for being with us
again. Thank you, Leonard. Good to see you again.